from Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, new developments in Detroit's bankruptcy. Who will blink first?
You know, they kept making the point, the pensioners need to sign on here. And I said to them at one point, it says, sounds to me like you're putting the cart before the horse here.
A new documentary film brings us the story of the Great Lakes as seen through its ice.
Over and over and over, we kept hearing climate change, global warming.
And we discover how Flint artists are changing the lives of young offenders through the spoken word and visual art.
Working with them and seeing the amazing abilities that these kids have has really given each of the artists a new focus in life.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Average gas mileage of new vehicles sold in the U.S. has steadily been improving. Greenhouse gas emissions are at an all-time low. The EPA recently set new emission standards scheduled to be phased in between 2017 and 2025 to reduce the amount of sulfur found in gasoline. But is this slow and steady climb in fuel economy and emissions enough? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, are the Obama administration's fuel efficiency goals setting the bar too low? Then a new documentary film brings us the story of the Great Lakes as seen through its ice. But first, there have been big developments this week in the high-stakes showdown over Detroit's pensioners, art treasures, and the creditors hoping to pressure bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes to, in turn, pressure the city to put those art treasures on the table. There's a lot to sort out. So, as we do each Thursday, let us turn to Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. And Daniel, it's gotten to the point where I think one could really use a business and finance degree to really understand all the elements involved in this evolving story.
Yeah, or you just have to understand the game of chicken. It's either or.
That's true. Well, let's start with the announcement from this group of creditors that they have proposals from private investors willing to pay, we read, up to $2 billion stake in the DIA's treasures. Can you spell this out for us?
Yeah, there's four different proposals that were put forth by a bond insurer out of New York called the Financial Guarantee Insurance Corporation. And two of them are based out of, one's in Hong Kong and the other is based out of Beijing, that would buy essentially pieces of the DIA, not the entire collection. And then you have two based out of New York that would essentially acquire all of the assets of the DIA, up to, as you said, $2 billion. Now, there's a lot of detail here. There's a lot of due diligence that would need to happen. Essentially, what they're asking is that the judge push the city into actually talking to these four groups and allowing them to do the due diligence. This would be in lieu of the so-called grand bargain financed by a dozen foundations, $350 million prospectively from the state, and $100 million from DIA donors for a total of about $816 million. This bond insurer says that is an inferior deal. It wouldn't actually be $815 million for the pensioners, and that their deals are better and would be designed to support all unsecured creditors.
Well, when we talk about especially the offers where they would say we were going to acquire the collection, is that meaning we're going to scoop up everything within the walls of the Detroit Institute of Arts and there would be no more DIA, or do they want it as collateral?
In the case of one called the Art Capital Group, the big one, the $2 billion one, they would essentially loan $2 billion against the entire collection, and the collection would stay in Detroit. At least that's what they're saying at this stage of the game. And a couple of the others are looking to acquire pieces. Mm-hmm. And in one case, Poly International Auction out of Beijing is looking to acquire the Chinese collection within the DIA.
And what about that messy little thing that is not so little, where so many of those pieces were donated with the stipulation they can never be sold?
Well, they draw some question to whether that, in fact, is true. I think a lot of us have expected that this was going to happen.
Okay.
At some point, creditors who feel they're getting the shaft were going to say, now, wait a minute, there's a lot of stored value here, and we don't agree that the city has accurately valued the art. They draw some real big questions about the Christie's valuation, which we've talked about.
Yes.
Say that they've lowballed it. They didn't assess enough and appraise enough of the pieces. It was only 5% of the total collection of 66,000 pieces, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
So I think now this goes before Judge Rhodes, and he has to decide essentially whether he is going to push the DIA and the city to actually dealing with these people, at least insofar as they would do any kind of due diligence. I think that's going to be very interesting to see. The creditors cannot force this like they could in a Chapter 11.
It's all up to Judge Rhodes.
It is, but even the judge cannot force the city to sell anything. In a Chapter 9 bankruptcy, the only entity that can decide whether it will sell an asset or liquidate an asset is the debtor, which in this case is the city, which is Kevin Orr, who works for the governor of the state of Michigan.
Meantime, this has to get pensioners thinking that there could be something beyond this so-called grand bargain. And isn't it understandable that retirees are reluctant to step out and support this grand bargain when they don't trust state lawmakers to then get on board that train? I mean, someone's got to blink here.
We had an interesting discussion earlier in the week with some members, people at the city, high-ranking officials, about kind of the details of the plan. And one of the points that they made was, you know, they kept making the point, the pensioners need to sign on here. And I said to them at one point, it says, sounds to me like you're putting the cart before the horse here. The legislature hasn't even acted. We don't expect the legislature to act until the end of May.
Yeah.
They said, that's true. However, the balloting process for pensioners is going to last for 2 months, starting May 1st and ending on June 30th. And their argument is that they're going to have clarity, the pensioners will have clarity on the state's action roughly right in the middle of that, because the governor has looked at this and said this is part of the budgeting process. This budget has got to be done by June 1st.
Okay.
So they should have clarity as to whether or not that money is in fact going to materialize, and therefore will be able to make their decisions accordingly. Now, obviously, I would think a vast majority of pensioners are not going to vote until they get some clarity on that, and I think people understand that. This is a very tight timetable. There's no question about it. But the other thing that's really important for people to understand, if the pensioners, the two classes who are voting on this, vote no on this grand bargain, that money disappears. It doesn't stay out there, and it can't somehow be used in a cram down, for example, where the judge orders a settlement on all of the creditors. Why? Because the foundations are not part of this. They are outside parties, so they can't be affected by a cram down. So if they were to say, no, we reject this plan, we think we're going to get better farther down the road, I think the evidence suggests that it won't. In these kinds of things, it usually only gets worse. It doesn't get better. And you really don't know what would happen with these other four proposals. Two of them we know already would break up the collection. And clearly that is something that a lot of people don't want to see happen.
I'm speaking with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes as we look at the unfolding developments in the Detroit bankruptcy. And let's talk now about what's seen as a kind of a win for Kevin Orr, and also probably somewhat of a win for this group of general obligation bondholders. They're now going to get 74 cents on the dollar. What happened here?
Now, this gets very complicated.
Yes, it does.
But initially, in his most recent plan, he said that these people would get 15 cents on the dollar. Now, you would say, well, if they were going to get 15, now they're going to get 74. They're getting a lot better. The difference is that under the new scenario that he announced this week, they have a claim to certain tax revenue from the city. And he acknowledges that they have a strong argument that if he would have tried to push through this 15% haircut that he originally proposed, he was likely to lose that argument. What he went to them and said is if you give us a portion of that revenue that we can then funnel into what is roughly a $100 million fund to benefit pensioners, we'll have a deal. And they said, okay. So they're essentially giving him a piece of that revenue, about roughly 24% of that revenue, that he is then using to create a fund to benefit pensioners, specifically a $50 million fund to benefit the people who have the lowest income of pension income, who, if their pensions do in fact get cut as proposed, they could be bumping close to the federal poverty line.
Yes.
And the governor does not want that. The city does not want that because of, A, what it implies, and, two, what it could ultimately cost the taxpayers, because those folks would then get other kinds of subsidies or need other kinds of subsidies from the taxpayer. So this is a fund that would essentially be used to bolster them. The net effect is that you get roughly another $100 million that gets laid on top of the 816 from the DIA fund. So now you're starting to get approach $1 billion. And I think they feel that that's going to be somewhat competitive, if you will, with some of these other proposals that are out there. And clearly this one's a lot farther down the road and a lot more developed, absent the state piece, than the other four that have just been proposed.
It certainly does prove, though, that these offers to creditors are fluid and can change.
Oh, I think we are at a point right now, Cynthia, where this changes on a daily basis. And people are in a deal-cutting mode. One of the things we've learned about bankruptcy in a context like this is you oftentimes fare better as a creditor by cutting your own deal than either, A, waiting for a ruling from a judge, or, B, potentially being on the short end of the stick in a cram down where in this context, Kevin Orr would use the deals that he already has in place as the lever to get the judge to impose a deal on everybody else. So you're generally in a better situation if you cut your deal in advance of that than if you wait to see what happens, which I think is really the big risk that pensioners need to think about. If they reject this DIA fund, the question is what comes after that?
Right.
You know, they've already told them that the numbers and the cuts get worse without this money. Now, they could say, well, if we reject the DIA fund, maybe we'll get one of these other one of these other four offers will come through. I suspect that given the way Chapter 9 bankruptcy works, that's a pretty tall order, but we have to really wait and see. And that's, I think, going to be the real challenge.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House with our Thursday check-in. Lots to talk about and lots to keep our eye on. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Those of us who live in Michigan really grew up with an ingrained awareness of the Great Lakes. We drink the water. We sail and swim in the lakes, build homes and cottages on their shorelines. And we live with the weather they help produce. And the Great Lakes are an economic power player, contributing $1 trillion to America's gross national product. And let's not overlook that $4 billion Great Lakes fishing industry. A new documentary film brings us a unique look at the Great Lakes. Project Ice explores the crucial role that ice has played and continues to play in shaping and maintaining Michigan's most important resource. We're joined now by the executive producer and the director of Project Ice, Bill Kleinert. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. So good to be here.
Well, this is a two-hour, gorgeously photographed documentary film, but it started, I guess, as a look at the historic ferries on the Straits of Mackinac. So how did it grow up and evolve into a look at the whole Great Lakes region?
It did. My writing partner, Brian Jeske, who's the Registrar of Historic Collections for the Mackinac State Historic Parks, he is the foremost authority on the car ferries that traverse the Straits of Mackinac. And, of course, these are car ferries because they're not automobile ferries. They're rail car ferries because they date back to the 1880s. And, of course, automobiles did not yet exist. So that was our initial idea, was to tell their story, because those early car ferries, which were designed and constructed to be able to work in the very difficult icy conditions of the Straits in the winter, those really are the progenitors of all modern icebreakers throughout the world. That many of the elements of design that were incorporated in those ferries are still in use today in icebreaker vessels throughout the world.
So it opened your eyes to the idea of ice.
It did.
And the impact.
It did. And we decided to go back and start looking, as you know, having seen the film now, we start looking about 30,000 years ago at the end of the last major ice age. and very rapidly then bring you to the present. But we show the geology and formation of the Great Lakes early on, and then we move into the first peopling of the Great Lakes by what we now would refer to as Native Americans. And then move rapidly to the European explorers. And so the vast majority of our story takes place, say, between 1850 and the present, and then looking beyond.
You had a lot of balancing to do in the story you tell about the Great Lakes, because there is the sense of the history, understanding. We learn more about ice than I dare say most of
yes.
your viewers will have ever known.
As I did.
We get a sense of the beauty, the fun, and the danger. So much to balance, and the economy,
yes.
the economics of the Great Lakes.
Yes.
Tough juggling act.
Yes, it was. And we literally had a large bulletin board in our primary studio, and we put cards for every segment, every interview, and every other, as we refer to them as action segment, up on that board. And that became a big juggling act, because we wanted to give the audience a story that they could follow. And we also wanted to inject in there our action elements that would keep it lively and interesting. So we did a lot of moving around.
It was so fun to meet people that cannot wait for winter and the ice to come. Let's take a listen to a clip from Project Ice. This is where we meet ice climber Bill Thompson, who really makes the most of the ice that comes from the Great Lakes.
It's just something that when you're swinging your ice axes and when you hit it and you know it's good, it's good. And the same thing with your feet. And I just love that feeling. When you're climbing, you totally forget about everything else and you're just listening to the ice. And I think it's just a unique experience.
Bill certainly puts those of us to shame who kind of think of winter and time to sit inside and get caught up on Game of Thrones.
No, he's out
drink
there.
Drink cocoa. He's out there.
He's
ice
out
climbing.
There just as soon as he can and as long as he can be.
It's a great, great segment. Yeah. We also meet pond hockey players.
Yes.
We meet ice fishermen. So these are the folks that really rely on the Great Lakes and on the ice and on the winter.
It's quintessential Michigan in winter.
It is. I'm speaking with Bill Kleinert. He's the executive director and the producer of Project Ice. It's a documentary film that looks at the Great Lakes and at the ice that's such an integral part of the lakes, past and present. As you spoke to the many experts you talked to who care deeply about the Great Lakes, did you hear common messages from them about their concerns for the lakes?
Over and over and over, we kept hearing climate change, global warming. We kept hearing about the lake level drop, the precipitous lake level drop. And that's when we realized that we really had a different focal point than the purely historical one at which we started. And we knew that needed to become the most important message that we were going to convey. And then we started digging further and further into the science behind that, and we found that with a lot of research and a lot of assistance from the NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory here in Ann Arbor, mm-hmm. We found that temperatures in the Great Lakes Basin over the past 40 years have been doing a upward rise that's highly demonstrable, and that Great Lakes ice cover and ice duration are doing exactly the opposite. Now, this year, obviously 2014
is quite the fluke.
it's an exception, but mm-hmm. there will always be those exceptions. Henry Pollack, who's also a professor emeritus of geophysics here at U of M and who shares the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore for his work on the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, he became our science advisor. So he's taught me an awful lot about the climate and ice and what's going on. And of course, you never look at climate is not a day. It's not a week. It's not even a given year. Climate is long-term trends. So we looked very carefully at the past 40 years and saw this very, very demonstrable increase in temperature and the very demonstrable decrease in ice cover and duration. Of note to your listeners, some of whom have maybe heard this, the National Climatic Data Center, which is located in Asheville, North Carolina, which is another part of NOAA, has the probably the best collection of climate data in the entire world for the planet, mm-hmm. not just for the United States. They announced just a few weeks ago that January was the fourth warmest on record for the globally. Hmm. So for the 134 years in which they have reliable temperature data. So that stands in stark contrast, of course, to what we experienced here in the Great Lakes with our polar vortex winter and extremely cold temperatures. But this is very much an outlier by comparison with the indisputable trend, which is increase in temperature and decrease in ice coverage and duration.
What kind of impact are you hoping that Project ICE will have as you get it out there, you get it in front of audiences? What
yes.
are you hoping?
Well, first of all, I hope that the audience walks away with a greater awareness of the role that ICE has played for us as a society, for us culturally, and throughout the Great Lakes region, and to the economy, of course. And it has implications both in the winter and in the summer. In the summertime, it has implications for the shipping cycle, because ships have to operate at lower drafts, because with lake levels lower, they cannot carry as much cargo. That means more trips, more expense. Recreational boaters, there are people throughout the Great Lakes region who have docks that are high and dry because the lake levels had fallen so much. And it has implications for the fisheries as well, because when there is ice cover present, that helps the spawning cycle for certain species of fish. When ice is not present, then that kicks up the wave action. Storms will disturb those spawning beds. Storms will also further erode the beaches and further erode the shoreline. Whereas if there is stable ice present, which is the historic norm, then that reduces the opportunity for that kind of erosion and that kind of destruction.
As much as it's a cautionary tale of what could happen, I do feel that Project ICE is also a love letter to the Great Lakes.
It is indeed.
If you would like to see a screening and see Project ICE for yourself, the Capital City Film Fest is a place to be in Lansing this Saturday at 4 p.m. at Dart Auditorium. There'll be a screening. And you're working on some other dates, including possible dates this summer in Ann Arbor.
Yes, indeed.
Well, you can get all the information about this remarkable film at its website. You can go to projecticemovie.com. Bill Kleiner, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing the story of how you came to make this remarkable documentary.
Thank you, Cindy. It's a pleasure to be here, and I hope that much of your audience has opportunity to see the film.
How do we really get through to kids who are headed down the path to trouble? Well, there's a group of artists in the Flint area who believe the answer is spoken word and visual art. The Share Art Project has been bringing artists together with young offenders. This is a collaborative effort among artists at the Buckham Gallery and the Genesee Valley Regional Center who are working with these young offenders. Shelley Spivak is a Buckham board member who chairs the program. So good to have you with us, Shelley.
Thanks for inviting us.
As you see these youngsters become exposed to spoken word and to the visual arts, what kind of changes do you begin to see?
We see a huge change. It may not be a change in that, you know, all of a sudden they are law-abiding citizens who never get in trouble again. The change we see is a change in their demeanor, in their ability to focus, a change in their ability to get along with their peers, and a change in their ability to get along with the supervision and the direction within the institution itself. Those are some of the kinds of changes that both we have seen as well as the staff at GVRC have seen.
And what about the artists who are working with these youngsters? How has this affected them?
I think it affects the artists almost more than it affects the kids. Each of the artists who's worked with us has had an overwhelming change in how they see themselves as artists and how they see the world. It's been a life-changing experience for everyone involved. Working with these kids who other people may see as hopeless or, you know, having no potential, things like that, working with them and seeing the amazing abilities that these kids have has really given each of the artists a new focus in life and in their ability to view them and then their views of themselves and how they view their art.
I'm speaking with Shelley Spivak, who is part of the Share Art Project, a collaborative effort in the Flint area between the Buckham Gallery artists and the Genesee Valley Regional Center, GVRC, working with young offenders. And Shelley, as you were working over these past 3 years with these youngsters, you noticed the boys tended to take to the visual arts and the girls favored spoken word?
Yeah. What we did was we had a pilot project in the first for 3 months in 2011. What we saw was the boys responded much more favorably to the visual arts. They were very reticent and hesitant to really embrace the concept of spoken word. The girls, on the other hand, embraced the concept of spoken word wholeheartedly. They wrote, and they wrote. They wrote in class. They wrote back in their rooms with notebooks we gave them. And they came ready to share and ready to really use the opportunity to get out what was in their feelings and what was in their heart. The boys, you know, were not so eager to do this. So, you know, that's one of the big things that we noticed after the first session. We also noticed that putting the boys and girls together was not a good idea, that the girls who are in the juvenile justice system have a lot of issues relating to past abuse and past sexual abuse. And they needed a safe space in which to explore these issues and to be able to write freely.
Shelley, yeah, I can only imagine in these 3 years that Share Art's been going on, you have met some very gifted young people. Are there particular artists or pieces that have really, really touched you?
Yeah, there are. You know, we have created three books of work. The first was boys and girls, and the second two were just the girls. Collections of the spoken word poetry. And what we've done the last time is included a piece by each of the girls. We've also had exhibits of the kids' artwork, and we're going to have our third exhibit. But back to what you're asking, like, when I look back and I read these collections, tears come to my eyes almost because I remember the kids who wrote these, and I can see them. And some of the stuff that they wrote, we have had, you know, amazingly gifted kids in there. They are all gifted in one way or another, but some of them have written things that, if you read it without realizing it, that it came from a detention center, you would have thought it was, you know, written by, you know, a gifted adult poet or something like that.
What about in the time now, in this, now that you've got 3 years of working with these youngsters, have you seen children dramatically change the course of their lives because of being exposed to visual art or spoken word?
Yeah, you know, there's one example that I can give. There was a young lady who I had previously encountered because in my role as a referee, I had locked her up on Christmas Eve. And so she remembered me and I remembered her. She was then again in the detention center and worked with us on the spoken word project. And she was one of the girls who really, really took to the idea of writing and wrote profusely. After she was released from the detention center, she went to a residential treatment program, and I was able to keep in contact with her through her probation officer. And she wrote me a letter that was just, you know, amazing, telling me that spoken word changed her life, that the ability to express in writing what she had gone through and to know that somebody was listening, you know, made her able to progress and to continue. And I kept in touch with her probation officer, found out that she came back to the community, graduated high school with honors. So, you know, that's kind of like a story that really, you know, shows that this really can touch people and it really can have an effect on how their lives can be improved.
ShareArt will be exhibiting the artwork and writing of these young people this Friday, April 11th. That exhibit will be at the Buckham Gallery in Flint. And we've been speaking with Shelley Spivak, who is a board member at Buckham, but as you mentioned, a family court referee since 2002. So seeking to use visual art and the spoken word to change young lives. Shelley, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate the chance to tell your audience about what we're doing in Flint.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The latest Michigan community to fall into financial collapse is the tiny half-square-mile community of Royal Oak Township in Oakland County. Late last month, Governor Snyder confirmed a financial emergency did indeed exist in Royal Oak Township, and that cleared the way for action under Michigan's overhauled Emergency Manager Act, PA 436. So what's happened in Royal Oak Township illustrates the changes and options available under PA 436 after voters rejected the previous emergency manager law in November of 2012. And we also wondered if other communities can learn cautionary lessons from the financial woes of Royal Oak Township. So we turn to Eric Scorsone, municipal finance expert from Michigan State University. So good to have you back on Stateside, Eric.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So under the previous Emergency Manager Act, Royal Oak Township would have wound up with an emergency manager, most likely. But PA 436 gives communities several options. Can we go through what those are?
Yeah, sure. Under the new law, PA 436, there are basically four options a community would choose if a financial emergency was declared, as it was by Governor Snyder in this case. Mm-hmm. They can choose consent agreement. They can choose to go directly to bankruptcy. They can choose neutral evaluation, which is kind of really a pre-step to bankruptcy, more of an arbitration process. And they can choose to go have an emergency manager directly.
And there actually had been some stories written that the possibility existed that they would petition for Chapter 9 bankruptcy. But indeed, Royal Oak Township officials informed the state treasury they've chosen a consent agreement. Is this what Detroit had prior to the bankruptcy?
Yes, Detroit had a consent agreement, although it was actually under the old law.
Right.
But, yeah, they had a financial stability agreement, which was essentially a consent agreement. And it's just simply a case where the local officials remain in charge of the government, but they're under a lot of contractual obligations of things they need to do to ensure that they remain in charge.
Well, the leaders in charge of Royal Oak Township, and again, as we point out, it's a tiny, tiny community, only a half square mile with 2,400 residents. We should also note not to be confused with the city of Royal Oak, which is just a few miles north of Royal Oak Township. But it's got such a long history of financial trouble, owing hundreds of thousands of dollars for police services. They failed to submit an annual budget, overspent their budget by $500,000. What questions does that raise about whether the folks in charge of that community can really do what it takes?
Well, it's a classic case like so many of these that we've seen in the past where, you know, as you laid out, the inability to control the budget, the continual running of deficits and then incurring debt and unable to pay bills to vendors, whether it be the sheriff department or the ambulance service. These are just classic symptoms of a community in trouble. And, I think it does ask the bigger questions of how do we get more proactive? I mean, we know some communities are in trouble because they have economic distress, mm-hmm. and so that often leads to these other problems. It's typically that process. I mean, occasionally you have something out of the blue. The most prominent one is Orange County, California, going bankrupt in the 80s, which had really nothing to do with their local economy. But generally speaking, we know these things are coming. There are a lot of economic distress. Often the city and the school district of the same area are in distress together. I think we need to do more to be more proactive because these things are often pretty well predictable.
Well, in fact, I'll tell you, I grew up in neighboring Ferndale, and my father, as a Ferndale firefighter, I know Ferndale provided firefighting services to Royal Oak Township decades ago, and it's had such a long history of being this tiny, tiny, struggling community. And we should note, Royal Oak Township's elected officials have refused to talk about merging with nearby Ferndale or Oak Park. And one has to ask, when is it time to throw in the towel and look at a clearly failing community and say it's perhaps time to merge.
Yeah, and I think we have to start asking those questions. And I have to say, I mean, the Treasury report that was given to the governor in this case, for the first time that I've seen, actually makes a statement to the effect of this may be the case where we have to essentially outsource all government services from our Royal Oak Township. Hmm. They don't quite say merger, but it's implied, honestly, in between the lines. And I think that's exactly the case here. We look at Highland Park, we look at Royal Oak Township, we look at communities, say, Buena Vista Township up in Saginaw, and, you know, the way I look at it is we could afford more communities in the past. We had more wealth. We had such a huge manufacturing sector. And you look at metropolitan Detroit, and it's filled with very small communities. And I'm not sure, you know, not all of them are going to be viable in the future. And I think we have to start asking questions. And I think we're going to need new laws. The current laws in Michigan are not favorable to government mergers. They're very difficult. I think we need to think of new ways of doing this, because I just think a lot of these communities are going to continue to face these struggles even as the state economy is improving.
And as you look across Michigan, you mentioned Buena Vista and Saginaw, but are there other Royal Oak Townships as we look into northern Michigan or we look into the Upper Peninsula? Are we seeing more of that as well?
Yeah, I know there is a community up near Cadillac, I don't remember the name, that has significant financial troubles. Mm-hmm. I think we've seen it on the west side of the state with Benton Harbor, and there's other smaller communities in that area. And I think, you know, it's mostly concentrated in the southeast, probably I-75 corridor, but I think we're going to see more of this because these communities, you know, again, they were afforded a tax base with the manufacturing sector that they simply can't manage anymore. And with state revenue sharing, you know, being reduced so much, I think we just have to look at new models and ask questions of whether these communities are viable anymore.
And it has to be, it would be clearly a difficult conversation because of just people's inherent pride in living in whatever township or community they live in.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no doubt if people, you know, want a community and they're willing to pay the price. I mean, you look at Royal Oak Township's tax millage, it was like 37 mils, which is really incredibly high. Because they had to maintain any kind of services. So I understand people's pride in their community and their need to want to maintain that community, but you have to ask at what point is there an economic rationale for having this community anymore? Or can it be more, I mean, you think about Okemos. Mm-hmm. Okemos doesn't exist. It's right, it's a school district. There's no city of Okemos. It's actually Meridian Township, but people talk about Okemos as if it was a town. And that may be a model saying you can still call yourself something. The post office will still reflect that. But maybe from a government standpoint, you know, it's a different structure now. And so I think that's the kind of thing we need to start thinking about, is how do we maintain that community pride but deal with the economic realities that people, you know, critical public services weren't being delivered in these communities often.
Eric Scorsone, municipal bankruptcy expert with Michigan State University. Thank you so much for talking with us, Eric.
Thank you.
There's an encouraging report just out from the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute about fuel economy. The average fuel economy of new U.S. light vehicles sold in March rose to 25.4 miles per gallon. Now, that's the highest since the researchers started tracking this data in October 2007. That got us wondering just how we are faring in the quest to squeeze out better mileage from our cars and trucks, and the quest to create electric, hybrid, natural gas, and fuel cell vehicles and technologies. We're joined by Charles Griffith. He's the Climate and Energy Program Director at the Ecology Center in Ann Arbor. Charles, we look back to October 2007, and we realize average fuel economy of new vehicles is now up 5.3 miles per gallon. Is this something to celebrate?
I think so. It's really good news, and it shows that both the automakers have worked really hard to meet the new standards, and of course, there's, you know, now legal reasons that they need to do so. But it also shows that they've sort of hit the nail on the head in terms of providing products that consumers are willing to buy.
So these are cars that are in driveways all across America. So
that's
people
right.
are living with these cars. We also found that the average monthly emissions generated by an individual driver for February also moved in the right direction, which is down. Is this due to what drivers are doing, or is this advances in technology by the automakers?
It's a little bit of a mix. I mean, as we just noted, mm-hmm. the technology is getting better, but also the way that consumers are choosing to use those vehicles is improving too.
And how so? What are we doing differently?
Well, what it means is that you're choosing to drive high mileage cars as much as possible. You know, many of us have a couple of cars in our garage, perhaps more, depending on the size of the family, and sometimes use different cars for different purposes. And so that's one of the factors, and one of the interesting opportunities as we sort of look at some of the advanced technologies. Because if you've got, you know, a vehicle that is great for taking the long trips, but maybe one that's great around town that's electric and can save you money and fueling at the same time, then more options are available to the average family.
Now, as you referred to earlier, the Obama administration made it the law. They set goals raising these CAFE standards. That's the corporate average fuel economy. And it's supposed to be 54.5 mpg by 2025. So in your opinion, is this setting the bar too low, too high, or is it about right?
I think in the near term, we're definitely on track. I think it's a good goal. In the long term, I actually am thinking that we could find that they're too low. While they seem pretty high right today, and I think you'll find a number of people saying, oh, you know, it's questionable whether we can keep that rate of technology development going. I've also been talking with some colleagues about the fact that, you know, this when you project out far enough, it gets hard to predict, right?
Mm-hmm.
We tend to be conservative in our projections and think more linearly. You know, we can only keep going at this 5% improvement a year, which is roughly what the EPA and the regulatory agencies determined was reasonable based on, you know, technology development.
And talking to the automakers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But a lot of times you also find with new technology that you get synergistic effects that no one could predict. And this colleague of mine has been actually looking into this and finding that, you know, more often than not, you find that you get bigger stepwise improvements in technology that you didn't know were possible because, you know, one technology that, let's say, might reduce the weight of a vehicle allows you to downsize the engine, which allows you to, you know, do other things which you hadn't really thought of before. 2017 is going to come up pretty quickly. We may not determine that there's any big breakthroughs by then, but we might at the same time.
So the view could be quite different by 2017 or 2018, thereabouts. So take it a few years out, and who knows?
Sure. Yep.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Charles Griffith, who is the Climate and Energy Program Director at the Ecology Center in Ann Arbor, as we talk about the quest to squeeze out better mileage from our cars and trucks, and also to look ahead to create electric, hybrid, natural gas, and fuel cell vehicles and technologies that really can be taken home by American drivers and used and loved. And when you talk about EVs, we know that the automakers had to cut prices on a lot of some EVs to get them moving off lots. Nissan's Leaf and Toyota's plug-in Prius, for instance, that the sales were short of the target, so they cut the prices. Was that consumer reluctance, do you think, due to this range anxiety, worrying, will my car die on me as I'm out on I-75 somewhere?
I actually don't think range anxiety is the reason. I think that it has more to do with, you know, consumer uncertainty about the technology. It's new, as well as the price premium that these vehicles carry. You know, I think they are affordable vehicles for some today. And, you know, if you take that larger upfront cost and spread it out over the life of a vehicle and look at the fuel savings from, you know, paying, you know, equivalent of maybe 50 cents a gallon for the electricity that goes into get you a mile of
versus the $3.79 a gallon.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, you start to recoup those price disadvantages. But, you know, it's got to work for the consumer. You got to be driving enough miles to be able to get that benefit. And you need to be able to drive enough miles in electric mode, which is the reason that you really need the and want to have more infrastructure available for recharging these vehicles. The reason that you want to have more availability of additional charging infrastructure is because, number one, that people want to get the maximum amount of driving in their electric car as they can. We want to sort of level the playing field between electric vehicles and the more conventional gasoline-powered cars. And, you know, where the fueling infrastructure is really abundant, you can go find a gas station on most corners.
Sure.
Right? So we need to add more value for consumers that choose to go electric so that they can get as many opportunities to recharge and or refuel their vehicle when they're out and about. And, you know, that part of that is just, you know, between work or, you know, the usual places that they go. But then looking out a little bit further, you start looking at, okay, well, how can I travel city to city and get more access to electricity? And there's some interesting examples out there. I don't know if you've heard about, you know, Tesla, which is unfortunately not one of the Michigan-made electric vehicle products
sure.
that we, of course, like to encourage folks to look at. They are building a highway that crisscrosses the country from west to east and north to south along the East Coast and West Coast so that Tesla owners can go and recharge their vehicles for free, and they can actually travel their all-electric Teslas from coast to coast and from border to border.
Never heard
of that. So that's pretty amazing and a very active role that the automaker in this case is playing to actually build out that infrastructure.
And is that type of example being watched by the other automakers?
Oh, yeah. People are watching Tesla very, very closely.
So where do you think, Charles, that we will be? Let's roll out 10 years from now. How what percentage do you think will of the cars on the roads, do you think we'll see that will be all these alternative vehicles?
I think we're going to continue to see steady growth in electric vehicles, and it will be aided if we can support that with investments in the infrastructure that I talked about. I'd like to see the state of Michigan support cities that are investing in that infrastructure, you know, maybe some kind of matching program. You know, it's good for the state because we are producing those vehicles in the state and we want to maintain that leadership. You know, our economic development officials have been great at attracting the industry here, but on the flip side, we haven't done as much as a number of other states in sort of encouraging the demand of those vehicles. And building out the infrastructure is one of the ways that you do that.
Interesting conversation, Charles, with Charles Griffith, who's the Climate and Energy Program Director at the Ecology Center in Ann Arbor. Thank you so much for joining us today, Charles.
It was a pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Tony Brown. Contributors are Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.